From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, in light of Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, we chat with a local doctor about prevention and care. Then writer and psychotherapist Lori Gottlieb talks about her own experiences going to therapy.
Even as a therapist, you might know something, you might know better, but you kind of do all the things that other people do when they're looking for a therapist, when they're going to therapy. You're just a regular person when you're on the other side of it.
And while singer-songwriter Juliana Hatfield is commonly known for her influence in the indie music scene, her recent project takes a deep dive into the Police.
I'm serious about it. You know, I'm not recording a cover of a big hit song just as a goof or as a novelty or for shock value or for any reason other than I just really want to immerse myself in something that I'm fascinated by.
Lake Effect is next, but first this news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It can be difficult for anyone to talk about a cancer diagnosis, but it's even more difficult when that cancer is in a part of the human body that we'd simply prefer not to talk about. March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and that reluctance to talk about it is part of what makes this month so important. Colorectal cancers are one of the most common cancers in the United States, and according to the American Cancer Society, more than 4% of people will develop one of these cancers during their lifetime. Dr. Carrie Peterson is an assistant professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin in the Division of Colorectal Surgery. She joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers in studio.
So I'm going to start with a question that might sound a little pedantic, but I think gets to a real misunderstanding about colorectal cancer. What is it? What kind of cancer is it?
So the colon and the rectum compose the large intestine. It's sort of the backside, the end of the GI tract, if you will. It's about 6 feet long, extending from the right side, going up and over and around, and then coming out your anus. So the colon is the first part of it, and the rectum is the last about foot, perhaps. And the function of the large intestine is primarily to change the intestinal contents from liquid into something solid that you can pass pretty easily. So it absorbs water and some electrolytes primarily as its significant function. And then cancer is any kind of growth that occurs within that organ, colorectal cancer. And we lump them together because they share a lot of characteristics. We do treat them a little bit differently, which is sort of interesting. But that's the primary sort of explanation behind that.
So is the main difference then between something like colon cancer and rectal cancer just where it is?
Correct. Yep, absolutely. The difference in where it's located. So the colon is that first part, the first 5 feet, and then the rectum is the last foot. And the rectum is sort of interesting because it is really within the confines of the bony pelvis. So it's bounded anatomically really differently than the colon is. The bladder is there. If you're a woman, there's a vagina and a uterus. There's bones from the tailbone and the sacrum and the hips that essentially surround the rectum almost entirely. So treating it is a lot different because it's a lot harder to get to for surgical treatments than the colon is, which is out free within the belly.
I was about to say, there's a lot of stuff that's just happening in that area in general. And when it comes to colon cancer, rectal cancer, obviously these are parts of our body that are in use constantly and constantly processing things inside of us. Yeah. Do we know what some of the causes of cancer in these parts of our body are?
We don't have a great understanding. There's a small number of patients that have a genetic cause, and we understand those fairly well. But in the vast majority of people, which is probably about 90% of patients, we don't really have a clear cause, an outright cause. There are some things that can predispose people to getting colorectal cancer, and we think there are some environmental things that can play an influence, and that's probably the biggest contributor. But we don't have a single sort of thing that we can say, like for lung cancer, for example, if you're a cigarette smoker or a pipe smoker, that tobacco and smoke exposure is a huge risk factor for lung cancer. But we don't have anything like that for colon cancer.
There's no silver bullet.
There's no silver bullet. Yeah, no.
If you do have colorectal cancer and it is more advanced, let's say even just stage one and beyond, how deadly is this cancer?
Well, if we look at all comers, so essentially everybody diagnosed with colon cancer, regardless of stage, in 5 years' time, 65% of patients will still be alive. So it's actually pretty good when you think about it compared to some other cancers like lung and pancreas, for example, which have worse outcomes. If you look at stage by stage, colon cancer, of course, the lower your stage, the better off you're going to be. So for stage one cancers, so these are really small cancers that haven't spread to the lymph nodes that drain the colon or anywhere else in the body, 5 year survival is about 95%. So the sooner we catch it, the better off you're going to be.
When it comes to the symptoms of colorectal cancer, especially, it seemed like they were also symptoms associated with a myriad of other conditions. So what are some of those kind of earmarks of colorectal cancer?
Yeah, bleeding is primarily the biggest symptom and one that people should watch out for. So if you have any kind of blood that shows up in your stool, that should be investigated and figured out where that's coming from. It doesn't always mean it's cancer, but it can be an indication.
Well, and when it comes to blood, what are we talking about? Because that gets confusing.
I was going to clarify, so thank you. Yeah, so you can actually see bright red blood, so fresh blood, that can show up, and that's characteristic of rectal cancers in particular. But it could also be blood that gets mixed in with the stool, and so you might not actually see blood. It can actually present as being anemic, so your blood counts within your blood vessels are low. You go to the doctor, you're feeling tired and fatigued, and they check your blood counts and you're anemic. And that can be another sign of cancer as well, essentially cancer that's bleeding. It gets mixed in with the stool. You don't see it outright, but we can do tests to investigate for that. And that can be another way that bleeding comes and presents in patients. So that's a symptom.
So if you're someone who has blood in their stool, someone who I think losing weight was another.
Losing weight can occur. Yeah, absolutely. Most often happens with more advanced tumors. So it's a later sign than other symptoms. And honestly, a lot of people with especially small early cancers don't really have symptoms. And that's the tricky part about colon cancer and one of the reasons that we recommend screening tests to try and identify people early so we can intervene.
So if you're someone who is afraid that this is a cancer you might have, maybe you've seen bleeding, maybe you have a family history of it, what would screening look like for you?
So if you're an average risk person, so essentially that means you don't have any personal history of colon cancer, you don't have any first degree relatives, so parents, siblings, or children with colorectal cancer, and you don't have any risk factors like inflammatory bowel disease or radiation exposure, all right, and you're over the age of 45, they just changed that recommendation now, you know. Then we would recommend that you start screening at about the age of 45. And there's lots of different screening options available. We generally lump them into one of two categories. So either a stool test or a visualization test. So the stool tests are very easy to do. It's essentially a test that looks for either blood or shed DNA within the stool itself. And so you can just do it at home. You essentially use the little kit, send the stool sample in, and then you'll get results back. And so it's pretty easy to do. Obviously, if it comes back positive, it needs to be investigated a little bit further because blood can be caused by other things besides cancer. So in that case, we would recommend another test, which is one of the visualization tests, like a colonoscopy, for example. That's the most famous one, right? And in that exam, it's a day surgery procedure. You essentially go into the office. They use a special camera on the end of a flexible scope to look at the inside of your colon and to look at potential sources for where that bleeding would be coming from and look for cancers. we can do things during that procedure that actually make it pretty advantageous. Of course, we can remove polyps, and we can take biopsies of cancers, and sometimes we can even remove really small cancers and treat them outright. So it's a really powerful test, which is why a lot of us really like to prefer that in some way. But it has risks. Not everyone can have that procedure. It requires sedation. It, you know, has risks like other procedures do. So it is something to be kind of cognizant of when you're talking about screening. So there's different options that people can choose from.
It's a screening that I think a lot of people have heard of and a lot of people have mixed feelings about. If you've ever prepared for a colonoscopy, even just the preparation is a little cumbersome.
Right. Yeah. And I would say most people, it's the preparation that's the barrier to getting this done, right? They don't want to spend an evening in the bathroom cleaning out their colon so everyone can get a good look with the scope the next day. To be honest, that's really the worst part about it, though, because you are asleep for the procedure itself. Most people don't even really remember it because we give you some medication, so you don't really remember. And once it's done, then, you know, you can be, if everything is clear, potentially 5 to 10 years, depending on what they find. So it's a long time to be able to not have to worry about it.
Yeah. So you mentioned, you know, inside of a colonoscopy, sometimes you can remove, I'm guessing, a stage one or a pre-stage one.
Right, correct.
Kind of cancer.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. What if you have these screenings and they find a more advanced cancer or a larger cancer that can't be taken out in this way?
Right. So colon cancer, so this is when we should talk about colon cancer a little bit differently than rectal cancer. So colon cancer is primarily treated with surgery. So when people are diagnosed with a new colon cancer on a colonoscopy, there's a few tests that we get to start off with, scans to look to see if the tumor has spread anywhere else primarily, and some blood tests that help us follow along during the course of the treatment. If the scan shows that there's no tumor anywhere else, then surgery is the primary treatment for that. And we would remove the part of the colon where that tumor is located, the lymph nodes that drain that area, and potentially put people back together all in one operation. With rectal cancer, it's a little bit different. And because of the anatomical confines of the pelvis, as we talked about, rectal cancer is usually treated with chemotherapy and radiation before surgery. And that accomplishes a few things. It gets the tumor to shrink down in size to make our operation a little bit better, and essentially decreases the chance that that tumor will come back down the road. And that's been traditionally the big struggle with rectal cancer, is the chances of it coming back is a lot higher than with colon cancer.
So one of the concerns that some people have about something like colon cancer, rectal cancer, the procedure can often come with some kinds of risks, which we've talked about.
Right. So the biggest thing I think that people are concerned about is the need to have a colostomy bag or some kind of an ostomy bag as a result of surgery. And what that is essentially bringing the intestine out to the skin instead of connecting it to the anus. And then you have an appliance or a little plastic bag that sticks to your skin, and your stool comes out of that piece of intestine and goes into the bag. And people are very concerned about this, understandably. It's an adjustment when this is needed. But the vast majority of the time, we don't have to have a permanent bag. Most colon surgery in particular, that's not required. And for a lot of rectal cancer surgery as well, a permanent bag isn't needed. Now, sometimes we do use a temporary ostomy to help the rectal cancer surgery heal, but usually it's only for a short period of time.
Okay.
And I would say that while it's a bit of an adjustment for patients to get used to it, once they've got the hang of it, it's really pretty straightforward and people do great. And you wouldn't even really know most of the time if you're just looking at someone walking on the street or at the grocery store that this is what's going on. So it's very manageable.
You know, we talked about kind of the causes and a lot of the mystery of what causes colorectal cancer. Mm-hmm. But do we know of any ways to at least reduce your chances of developing either colon cancer or rectal cancer.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds kind of hokey, but the best recommendations we have right now are sort of what your mom would say, like eat a healthy diet. And by healthy, we mean high fiber, lots of fresh fruits and vegetables, whole grains particularly. Get exercise, maintain a healthy weight, and don't smoke tobacco is another one, actually. Tobacco use is a huge risk factor for colon cancer. So, but other than that, no. There's some data that things like calcium and vitamin D and anti-inflammatory medications might play a role in reducing the risk, but that data is not really conclusive at this point in time, so we don't recommend necessarily taking a daily aspirin to reduce your colon cancer risk, per se.
Yeah. All right. Well, Dr. Peterson, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Carrie Peterson is an assistant professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin in the Division of Colorectal Surgery. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in light of Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. Coming up next, psychotherapist Lori Gottlieb talks about her new book called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Most psychotherapists spend their day listening to other people's problems. But that job becomes complicated when a psychotherapist is dealing with their own catastrophic life events. So how do they handle all of that? Writer and psychotherapist Lori Gottlieb talks about her own journey dealing with a difficult breakup and her day-to-day work in her newest book called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. She shares her personal struggle dealing with a life-altering breakup, her experiences in therapy, and the patients who taught her as much about their lives as they did her own. Gottlieb joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio to talk about her book and her unique journey to becoming a psychotherapist.
How did you first become acquainted with therapy?
I first became acquainted with therapy because I had been to therapy before, and I never imagined that one day I would become a therapist. I just found it really useful in my life. And it wasn't until later on when, I sort of had this very nonlinear path of working in story and the human condition from different angles. That was in the film business, television, going up to medical school, becoming a journalist. And it was through that process that ultimately I decided that I wanted to go from helping people to tell their stories to helping people to change their stories.
In the book, you talk about this idea that a therapist should be essentially a mirror for a patient. And it reminds me of this idea in journalism that objectivity is king and opinions, you know, are this kind of sin. And the central conceit of your book is that therapists are just human beings with flaws and limitations. Is that a difficult concept for you to grapple with as a therapist? Because as a journalist, it's certainly something that I grapple with.
Well, what I'm really trying to show in the book by bringing myself in, so we follow four of my patients as they go through their struggles, and I'm helping them with that. And then the fifth patient is me as I go through something with my own therapist. And the reason that I wanted to show both sides of that is because, like I say at the beginning of the book, my greatest credential is that I'm a card-carrying member of the human race, that I bring my humanity into the room all the time. And I think as a journalist, because I also work as a journalist, and I had for many years before becoming a therapist, you bring yourself into the interaction with the person that you're talking to. So that doesn't mean the interview is about you. It doesn't mean the therapy session is about you. But it means that when you are trying to connect with another person, you have to bring your humanity into that experience.
It has to be a little difficult as a therapist, because something that comes up in the book is, you know, you don't want to share too much of yourself with your patients because ultimately you're there to talk to them, not talk about yourself. But there also then becomes this kind of avoidance that can be a real impediment and can lead to something like lying. How do you strike that balance?
So in the book, there's this example of an intern who was going on vacation and lied about where he was going by omission, you know. And I think that it's really important that the relationship is about the person who's coming in for help. So I think there are ways to say, you know, there are ways not to answer a question without lying. And there are ways to talk about in the room with the person, you know, this really feels too personal, or this really isn't about me, and to talk about what their curiosity is about and what they imagine having this answer would do for them. But I also think that again, we need to be human. There are certain things where, you know, I think nowadays therapists are much more open. And again, I don't mean that they're revealing things about their lives willy-nilly, but I mean that, you know, if someone says, you know, do you have children? Maybe we would answer that question depending on the context and why they're asking and how we think it might benefit them to know this or not know this. So we're always weighing whether this is going to benefit the patient. How will this benefit the patient? If it won't, we're not going to go there. But if it will, maybe we might bring that into the conversation.
Do you think sharing parts of yourself is important for these kinds of relationships? Because, you know, I'm someone who has gone to therapy, although not in a while, and some of the people I knew quite a lot about, some people I knew almost nothing about, and it does impact your relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. So as a rule, we're not going to bring personal information about our lives into the room, but very strategically, we might. So there was a colleague of mine who was seeing somebody whose son had Tourette syndrome, and this patient felt very alone, like nobody understood her experience. And the therapist happened to have a son who has Tourette's. And at one point, you know, very far into the relationship, it wasn't at the beginning of the relationship, she revealed that. And it really helped this person. It helped this person to know that what she was talking about, the therapist truly understood in a very visceral way. So they didn't talk about the therapist's son in their work. They talked about the patient's son. But just knowing that the therapist understood on a completely different level really helped this person. You know, and there are many other instances where somebody wouldn't bring that up.
Yeah. One of the central relationships that you discuss in the book is with a woman who has terminal cancer. Is she someone who I certainly identified with in part because I think a lot of us live our lives kind of the way she was living her life. And then when she's confronted by, you know, a life-altering, life-ending event, it's how she deals with it, it is very human. And I think we learn a lot about you in that relationship. What did you learn from that?
It was a really difficult experience to watch this person who was so lovely go through this process of dying right in front of me. And to go through it, not just in front of me, but with her in a way. And at the same time, there was so much vibrancy. There was the room was alive when she was in the room in a way that sometimes it isn't with other people, because I think that the awareness of our limited time really brings things into focus. You know, she made me much more aware of my mortality. We all know that life has 100% mortality rate, but we kind of think, yeah, that's for other people, or yeah, that's a long time away. But the truth is that most of us don't know how or when we're going to die. And I think that if we live our lives more intentionally every day, we don't need a terminal diagnosis to have that awareness and to really make conscious choices and not kind of skate through life. And so that's what I really learned from her, was to make sure that to live while I'm living.
Yeah. The book, of course, is called A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. And I don't want to reveal too much about the book, but throughout it, you're going through a pretty life-altering experience, which is what brings you back to therapy. And I liked the analogy you used, you know, water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink. Of course, so many of your relationships are with other therapists. And you had very specific qualifications that you wanted out of the therapist. I'm curious, why? Why did you want such a specific kind of therapist?
Well, I think what's so funny about that is that even as a therapist, you might know something, you might know better, but you kind of do all the things that other people do when they're looking for a therapist, when they're going to therapy. You know, you're just a regular person when you're on the other side of it. And I had this idea that if I went to this specific kind of therapist, that this kind of therapist would validate my position, and then I would feel better. And of course, that's not what this therapist does, which was the best possible thing that could have happened. And so I think that a lot of people come to therapy because they want to tell their story, and they're so sure that their version of the story is the accurate version of the story. And yet we're all unreliable narrators. We all have faulty narratives, and often those faulty narratives are the things that are tripping us up. They're the things that are getting in our way. It's our blind spots. It's the part of the story that we can't see. It's the other person's perspective. And so a lot of times people are surprised that when they come to therapy, their therapists are sort of asking questions about their story and looking for, you know, what are sort of the parts of the story that are missing? What are the parts that maybe they're emphasizing or minimizing? How can they see themselves more clearly? I talk about the difference between idiot compassion and wise compassion. Idiot compassion is what we do with our friends, like, you know, yeah, that guy broke up with you. He was such a jerk. You dodged a bullet. Or, yeah, your boss didn't promote you. He doesn't see how talented you are. She doesn't see how talented you are. And it's like, yet a lot of times we can see what's going on with our friends. We can see that this happened the last three times in their relationships because that person is very suspicious and always going through the other person's phone, or because the person didn't get the promotion because they actually aren't putting in the work, or they don't get along well with their colleagues. But we don't say that. We don't say, if a fight breaks out in every bar you're going to, it might be you, which is what they really need to hear. And so when people come to therapy, they get wise compassion, which is, well, what do you think is the underlying struggle or pattern that has gotten you into the situation in the first place? And that can be life-changing.
Yeah, it was interesting. Although you have all of the tools of a therapist, you did have this experience that was, of course, like any other patient. And it's interesting because the book vacillates between your experiences as a therapist and then your experiences as a patient. When you were going through that moment, when you were living through that moment, did you see all of those parallels in real time?
No, I didn't. I didn't always see them in real time. Sometimes I did. But often, you know, you don't realize what you're doing. And I think that's the way that sometimes we can't see ourselves clearly. The beauty of being outside of someone's life is you have the vantage point of not of zooming out, of not living so closely to the issues, so you can see them more clearly. And I think that's what good therapy does for people. It helps them to see themselves in a more accurate way, and it helps them to see their own role in their situation. So a lot of people come into therapy and they want something to change, and usually what they want to change is someone else or something else. And what they come to realize is that they have a role in what's not working, and that's changeable. They have so much agency in their own lives that they've given up because they feel helpless in their situation. And what we try to say is, here's where you have choices. I want you to look at all of the choices that you have, and then here's how you can make better choices.
And I think this kind of gets to my last question. What do you hope people take away from this book?
I hope that they feel more connected to one another. I think that every single person who reads this book will see themselves in one of the five people, including me, in the book, not because they're so similar to those people, but because underlying whatever issue that person is coming in with are the same universal struggles, feelings, the ways that we trip ourselves up, the ways that we self-sabotage. I think human beings are ridiculous, and I say that affectionately, because I think that sometimes we take ourselves so seriously and we can't see the humor in our lives. And I want people to find more joy. I want them to navigate their relationships more smoothly. And the title of the book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, doesn't mean everybody should go to a therapist. It means we need to be talking more to one another. And I hope that that's what they take away from the book.
Lori Gottlieb is a psychotherapist and the writer behind the weekly Dear Therapist column in The Atlantic. She spoke with Like Effect's Joy Powers about her latest book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. And Gottlieb was scheduled to chat with Powers at the Italian Community Center this coming Monday, but the event has been canceled. So if you registered for this event, you'll be contacted directly by Boswell Book Company. Coming up next, we have an in-studio performance and conversation with singer-songwriter Juliana Hatfield. Like Effect returns in a moment, here on WUWM. Like Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
There's a hole in my life. There's a hole in my life. Shadow in my heart. It's tearing me apart. Maybe it's just something in my
Juliana Hatfield's name is solidified in the world of music. The singer-songwriter and band leader has over three decades in the indie rock scene with bands like the Blake Babies, Lemonheads, the Juliana Hatfield 3, and let's not forget all of her work as a solo artist. Hatfield's latest musical endeavor has been cover albums entirely devoted to an artist or band. Her first cover album dived into Olivia Newton-John, and her latest is Juliana Hatfield Sings the Police. For Hatfield, the cover albums go beyond a simple appreciation for the songs. She puts her own unique interpretation into them, as well as performing all the vocals, guitars, keyboards, and over half of the bass and drums. Hatfield was recently in Milwaukee on tour, and she joined me in the Lake Effect Performance Studio to share some acoustic versions of songs from her cover albums. She begins with playing The Police's Hole in My Life. That's Boston's Juliana Hatfield playing from the second installment in her covers project, Hole in My Life by The Police. So, Juliana, thank you for opening that with us. I'm curious, where did your love of The Police first start? And do you have a memory of the first time you heard them?
I don't remember the very first time I heard them. I don't remember how it started, but I just remember being a really fanatical, obsessive fan. I think I came to them a little bit late. I was a little young when their first few albums came out. Too young to appreciate it at the time or to be aware of them. But So I think I came into them around the time of Synchronicity, around 1983, and then I sort of worked backwards from there.
And what about them kind of grabbed you and held your musical attention?
Well, the songs were really, really catchy. Some of them were like almost like nursery rhymes, like do 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 da 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 da, and just very, very hooky. But then if you looked a little closer and a little deeper, you could see that there were like a lot of deeper meanings and a lot of sort of existential questions, which I was grappling with at the time in my adolescence. And, you know, like the songs that sounded like maybe they were just straight up love songs, if you looked more deeply, you could see that they're like a little bit twisted, more like psychodramas, like Every Breath You Take is not a happy love song, it's more of a stalker song. And
right.
I just found, yeah, and I found the combination of the really catchy melodies and the darker, deeper subject matter was really intriguing to me and more interesting than stuff that was maybe a little bit more shallow.
Yeah, and considering the darker subject matter, especially against the crazy world of 80s music videos that kind of have nothing to do with the song lyrics in themselves.
Yeah. And then there was also the sound of Sting's voice, which I always loved the sound of. It's a unique voice. He doesn't really sound like anyone else. And he sings in a high range, and so it was really easy to sing along to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that kind of flows well into this next question. I'm curious how you approach covering someone else's or a band's song, because you do have to balance being faithful to the original so that people at least somewhat recognize it, but yet you also need to add your originality to it. So what lends itself to you? What works the best when you are approaching projects like this?
Well, the way I work is very intuitive. I try not to consciously think too much about what I'm doing. I just kind of dive into a song and I just kind of wrap my hands around it and start kneading it and pulling pieces off. And a song starts to feel like it's mine. It starts to feel like maybe a change in the melody will happen, or like I'll come up with a new voicing for a chord. But it's all just stuff that happens really organically, and I don't question it too much. And if it just starts to feel like not natural, then I'll go with it. But sometimes a song, sometimes I can't make it feel comfortable to me. And so sometimes, as much as I love a song and I would love to sing it or record it, I have to drop some of them because they're just not working. Like they won't. Like a song will tell me what it wants me to do to it. And sometimes a song will tell me, like, leave me alone, don't do this. This is not your song. You know, does that make
sense?
Yeah,
no, absolutely. Yeah. And especially because you are the support for all the backup tracks. I mean, the Police had four guys, different instrumentation, and you yourself are taking on all those different parts. So for things like, I know you chose a drum machine because of, you know, to replicate Stuart Copeland's style is a lot. It's daunting. So I'm wondering, were there any aspects of those sounds or the Police's sounds or song structure that you were excited to take on and tackle, like, as a good challenge?
So there's the intimidating part, just thinking about Stuart Copeland's drumming is pretty sick, and then Andy Summers' guitar playing is pretty sick. So I don't try to copy any of that, because that would just be pointless. And then there's a lot of melodies that were really fun, and really I knew them all so well that singing them was just a breeze and a blast. Like a song like Canary in a Coal Mine, singing the melody and then adding the harmony vocal on top of it all throughout the song was really fun for me. I just love that. I love singing those melodies.
Yeah. Well, let's hear another one of those melodies. What are you going to play for us next?
I'm going to do Roxanne, which is this version here on acoustic guitar is pretty broken down. It's you'll see that I'm leaving out the title, the repetition of the title, Roxanne. On the album, I'm triple tracked singing the Roxannes, but in this version, I'm going to do it a little bit more naked and stark.
Excellent. Well, here's Juliana Hatfield playing Roxanne by the Police.
Roxanne, you don't have to put on the red light. Those days are over. You don't have to sell your body to the night. Roxanne.
I love you since I knew ya. I wouldn't talk down to ya. I have to tell you just how I feel. I won't share you with another boy. You know my mind is made up, so put away your makeup. I'll tell you once, I won't tell you again. It's a bad way, Roxanne.
Juliana Hatfield playing the acoustic version of Roxanne by The Police. Now, you yourself have your own musical career, your own albums, tons of albums over the years. How do these cover album projects feed you creatively? Does it help you regroup from your own work or re-energize or anything like that?
I like to think that learning and playing other people's songs will help me with my songwriting, but I have, unfortunately, these habits, things that I keep going back to, like voicings of chords and the way I write melodies. I really seem to have these things in my DNA. But I'm hopeful. I'm always hopeful that other songs will get me out of my own habits, and I don't know if they do, but I like to think so. And it's nice to take a break from writing and really exploring other people's music, just because it's all just information, and it's all part of my ongoing lifelong education and just learning, trying to figure out the way Andy Summers put chords together, and you know, watching his fingers. It's very definitely educational, and I picked up some things from watching him and learning from him, for sure, that I hope I will take back to my own writing, hopefully.
Maybe you can tell me better than I can assume anything, but is there a challenge of overcoming the negative stereotypes of doing covers? Because people think of cover bands, they don't think too highly of that, but it's doing a cover album is much different than people would assume is like doing a karaoke song. You know, you are diving into these and deconstructing them, as you mentioned.
Yeah, I think that doing a whole album of one artist's songs is it's proof that I'm serious about it. You know, I'm not recording a cover of a big hit song just as a goof or as a novelty or for shock value or for any reason other than I just really want to immerse myself in something that I'm fascinated by. You know, I was fascinated by this band in high school, and the songs really hold up. It still does have this fascination and just the hugeness. Some bands and artists become so world-renowned and so successful and popular that they just, like, transcend understanding. Like, there's no making sense of it. It's just, like, a phenomenon. And The Police were kind of like that. So I guess diving into the songs is a way to break down the mystique or the hype around something that was so big, and breaking it down to what was really great about them, which was the music and the combination of the musicians, the songwriting, and the chemistry that they had. So it's just a whole album of songs, testament to how serious I am about the music and how much I loved and love the music and music in general. It's really a celebration of love for something that we all shared then and we can still share now.
Definitely. Your first covers album was for Olivia Newton-John's songs. What did you learn from that first experience that helped you this second time around now with The Police?
Well, I think that doing the Olivia Newton-John record was very much of a challenge for me. It was pretty complicated. It was like a very, very complex puzzle with a lot of pieces. In terms of the songwriting, was some of it was really, really sick. And I mean that in a good way. Like it was, you know, songs would move into different modes, and some of the chord progressions, like a lot of chords in certain songs. And then singing those Olivia Newton-John melodies was tough for me. Her range is really wide, and I think it made me understand fully how underrated she is as a singer, I think. You know, there are people who think of her as like a cupcake, a sweet treat, but she's a really talented vocalist. So it was the difficulty of doing that album partly made me want to go to the police, which for me was a lot more easy and fun to do, because the songs were a little bit simpler, and I was very, very comfortable with all of the police melodies, having been such a extreme fan and knowing all the melodies inside and out. And also I sang in a cover band in high school, and we did a lot of police songs.
Yeah.
So I was just like, the police songs, I could sing them with, you know, in my sleep with my hands tied behind my back and tape around my mouth, across my mouth.
Yeah.
Whereas the Olivia songs were much more of a physical and technical challenge. So the police was more of a fun ride for me.
Excellent. Has anyone from the police or Olivia Newton-John reacted to your covers?
Well, her people, her quote-unquote people, were aware of the project early on because my record company reached out to them to have a conversation about the fact that we wanted to donate $1 from the sale of every record to Olivia's. She has a cancer research and wellness center in Australia. So they were really cool about that. And so Olivia was aware of it, and she tweeted a couple times about it. And she was just like they put the news about it up on Olivia's website. And so she was very, very gracious and generous about that. It was great.
Well, I've certainly enjoyed the little taste you've been giving us and our audiences. And I'd like to take it back to Olivia Newton-John for our last song. What would you like to take us out with?
I'm going to do Please, Mr. Please.
In the corner of the bar, there stands a jukebox with the best of country music, old and new. You can hear your 5 selections for a quarter and somebody else's songs when yours are through. I got good Kentucky whiskey on the counter, and my friends around to help me ease the pain. Till some button pushing cowboy plays that love song, and here I am just missing you again. Please, Mr. Please, don't play B-17. It was our song, it was his song, but it's over. Please, Mr. Please, if you know what I mean, I don't ever want to hear that song again. If I had a dime for every time I held you, though you're far away, you've been so close to me, I could swear I'd be.
Juliana Hatfield is a musician and singer-songwriter from the Boston area. She's known for the indie rock bands The Blake Babies, Some Girls, The Lemonheads, and her own band, the Juliana Hatfield 3. Her latest album is Juliana Hatfield Sings the Police, and she joined us in the performance studio while she was in town touring. Our studio session was recorded by Jason Reedy. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and won't you join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Like Effect, That's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.
Please, mister, please, don't play P-17. It was our song, it was his song, but it's over. Please, mister, please, if you